supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. You know, throughout recorded history, we've always tried to control our desires. Note the apple in the Garden of Eden, or the 10th commandment that says, "You shall not covet." Well, come on, we all covet. The problem is, we also all eat that forbidden fruit. So what is this thing called desire, and what is it around the holidays that seems to make our desires more powerful, more demanding, more urgent? Joining me here in the studio is Barry Schwartz. He's a professor of social theory at Swarthmore College, author of many, many works, but we're talking specifically about the paradox of choice. He argues that too many choices raise our level of distress and can make us miserable. Barry, it's nice to have you on.
Great to be with you, Dan.
On the phone in Woodstock, New York, is Dr. Mark Epstein, psychiatrist and Buddhist, author of many books, including Open to Desire. His latest book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. He suggests that desire itself is a good thing and that our fear of our emotions is what causes suffering. Mark Epstein, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
And I'd like to get the conversation started with you, our listeners. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What do you desire, and do you wrestle with your desires? Let me reframe that. Which desires do you wrestle with? Which are the most difficult? 888-477-9499. Barry, let's start with you. The holidays seem to increase our appetite for wanting more. More of everything, you know, material, food, alcohol. Are we just blindly obedient to market forces, a kind of a mind meld who tell us we need stuff?
Well, I wouldn't say blindly obedient. I think we are willing co-conspirators. It's very hard to resist the kind of official expectations about what the holidays are supposed to be like, and they're almost entirely supposed to be about consumption of various kinds. You're bombarded with commands from every conceivable source. I mean, it used to be Black Friday. First it was just Friday, and then it was Black Friday, and now it's Black Thursday. It's like the official American sport is not football. It's actually shopping. So, you know, you're not part of the program unless you participate in all of these things. And it feels like, oh, you're almost a Scrooge-like antisocial person if you say, bah, that's not for me. It's superficial. It's materialistic. And so I think we sign on, although it's a lot easier to go along in that direction than it is to resist.
What's your take on this, Mark? Do outside forces in general, but here specifically market forces, what do they do to our brains, our minds and hearts?
Well, our brains, our minds and hearts are not just individually determined; they're determined by our environment. You know, we're interactive, relational species, so we're making the world that we're living in. In the talk about the holidays, though, and desire and consumption and everything, I think sometimes we forget that people are doing all of this shopping as much to give as to receive. And it's very good for our brains, our minds, and our hearts to be giving. There's a greater joy, really, in giving than in partaking or consuming. And I think that actually is part of the shopping frenzy that the markets are counting on, and that's not a bad thing.
Well, if giving is about love and kindness and generosity, and boy, if we could all stop and think about why we're doing what we're doing, you know, we might get there. But, gee, Mark, so many people, it becomes an obligation, a source of stress. You got to give the right thing and when and how and what are they going to think?
Yeah, well, that's all true.
That's Barry, when we spoke with you earlier, you said that our whole culture takes leave of their senses for a month, and you said that no one disagreed with you when you mentioned that. But I'll bet they didn't have time to talk about it because they had to go shopping.
Well, you know, I think that when I talk to people, many people, they don't approach – it's kind of sad how few people approach the holiday season with eager anticipation and joy and warmth in their hearts. People are living lives with no slack, and into this completely overstuffed life comes a new set of obligations and responsibilities, as you put it just a minute ago. Where are you going to find the time to do it? How are you going to find the time to do it right? When are you going to find the time to actually enjoy being with the people who you only see once or twice a year? In my experience, the holidays are experienced much more as a burden than as a cause for celebration. And people know this, but they can't seem to get out from under the expectations that everyone has about what you're supposed to be doing.
I want to talk with you, Mark, about choice. Mm-hmm. Now, on the surface, it looks like we've got a lot of choices here, and you know, Barry would rightly argue too many choices. They're stressful. But it does seem like we have choice about what we buy for whom, and we have choice about why we buy. But we go blindly through so much of this. You know, we make the list, we check off, we pick up the gifts. It's as though we really don't have a choice. And I know with your mindfulness practice and teaching and mine, it really is about choice when we take
yeah,
that breath,
well, I agree with everything that Barry is saying so far, and I agree with what you're saying about the choices that we appear to have. As a therapist, though, you know, I spend most of my days one-on-one with people talking about their inner struggles, and I think what we don't have so much choice about is what we're feeling, and a lot of people have very deep and I would almost say primitive feelings about the holidays, about Christmas, a longing for some kind of completeness or wholeness or love that they associate with when they were little, that they're still wishing for, you know, and trying to either replicate or achieve something that wasn't really there in the first place. And so there's a built-in kind of disappointment, I think, that is underlying a lot of these apparent choices that we're making. There's a kind of compulsion underneath it all that's I think, doomed in a way. And I think that's part of the burden that Barry is talking about, the underlying psychic burden anyway.
I want to just take a second and reintroduce you guys. We're talking about desire here, and what is it, and what happens that sometimes desire feels good, and sometimes it feels out of control. What is this phenomenon? So we'd like to hear about your desires and what they are, where they come from, and how you manage them. We're talking with Barry Schwartz and Mark Epstein. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Rona on the line. Hey, Rona.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Barry. This is Rona. I don't know if you remember me from years ago.
I sure do.
Good. So here's what I'm thinking about this, listening to the show. When I was a kid, we did not have a lot of money. There was a year that my parents couldn't even afford holiday decorations, and my uncle came up with the money for them, and, you know, very tiny gifts. And then as time went on and we all got more affluent, I began to work. My father's job was better. And there were years we had so many gifts in those days that everybody felt like, I mean, it took us hours to open them, and everybody was so happy that we had made it, you know, that we were affluent enough that we could treat each other. I mean, it really was, we appreciated getting, but we liked giving also. And then as time went on and we got used to that, it flipped to feeling more burdensome, feeling more wasteful. The younger kids, the next generation, began to lobby for not gifts, but giving money to charity in each other's honor, which some of us were able to do and others didn't want to give up the gifting. So I just wanted to make that observation.
Thanks so much for your call. Barry.
Yes, you know, here's an analogy to the point that Rona made. Suppose you have a job, you work in the Wall Street, and you get an annual bonus, and it's an expected, it's essentially a guaranteed bonus. There is a sense in which the bonus is not a bonus. It's just part of your salary. So when you get the bonus, it's an entitlement. You know, for some reason, instead of paying me every month, they give me this gigantic check at the end of the year, but it's just part of my salary. If bonuses are not sort of contractual, if they are rare, if they're unexpected, then the response we have when we get a bonus is entirely different. Mm-hmm. It's a sign of appreciation for our hard work. It's a sign of dedication to us and commitment to us, and it matters. And I think the trick is to continue to regard this gift-giving thing as something special, not an entitlement, not to be taken for granted, not merely a responsibility. Then when you get a gift, it's wonderful. And when you give a gift and you see the reaction on somebody's face, it's wonderful. But the trouble is it's very, very hard to maintain that attitude when everyone expects the gift-giving almost as an obligation to happen every year at the same time. Then it's just a chore.
So I listen to this, Mark, through my ears as a clinician. And, you know, things like habituation come to mind and desensitization, you know, the same things happen over and over again. But I also wonder about not addiction, but it's got the same feel as addiction. We get it, and then we want it again, and then we want more, and we want it to be bigger, and we're always looking for that surprise element or looking for ourselves to feel the same way we did the first time it happened.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about desire. There's always a gap with desire. You long for something, and if you find it, if you eat it, if you make love, it's over, you know, and then you're still there. So there's a brief flash of like yourself dissolving into the sensory pleasure, but then you're back there again, you know, and I think that that's actually the illuminating thing about desire. Where addiction comes in is where people are rushing to eliminate that gap. So then they have to hurry up and take more of whatever the last thing was that gave them that feeling of release. And then they get into a loop because it's never as good as it was the first time. But if you can work with desire really in an almost spiritual way, then you start to realize that the gap is part of the experience, and that you're kind of washed back up on yourself, and there might be something to work with there.
Wait. Let me back you up. Yeah, exactly. Let me back you up about a half a paragraph. So, desire, work with desire?
Work with desire, yeah.
Tell me, how do you work with desire and make it into something spiritual?
Well, I was very inspired by a poet named Ann Carson, yeah, who wrote a book of essays called Eros, the Bittersweet. She's a Greek scholar and translates the poems of Sappho and so on.
Mm-hmm.
She said that the original word, the Greek word for bittersweet, is actually sweet bitter. The sweetness comes first and then the bite. You know, because of what I was trying to say before, that desire can never totally reach its goal. There's always a bit of a gap, you know, because you're still left washed up at the end of the experience.
What is the goal of desire?
The goal of desire is to lose yourself completely, I think, because it's painful being a self. It's painful being a person because you feel yourself to be all alone and in need.
Well, you can lose yourself in other ways. I mean, other than, you know, great food and great sex, not to...
No, tell me, how do you lose yourself? Tell us another way. Yeah,
you really want to know?
Yeah.
Because I have an opening in my schedule on Tuesday at 10.
Well,
no,
you know,
but look what Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi wrote in his book Flow. I mean, yeah, we've all had experience where there's just no self. It's just, you know, we're lost in the experience.
Yeah, but it's temporary. It's temporary, and then you're back again. And that's what fuels what you were asking about before, the addictive spiral.
But,
because most people find it painful to be back in themselves again, and then they're hurrying to get out. And what I'm saying is that it's possible to work even with the painful aspect of things.
Well,
but that's part of embracing desire.
So I guess I should not fill in that appointment for Tuesday.
You could still come.
Damn. Barry?
Well, I think your mentioning of Csikszentmihalyi is quite apt. There's a kind of... when we speak of desire for things, I think that this kind of inevitable disappointment that we've been hearing about is inevitable. And, you know, there's a momentary flash of desire satisfaction, and then the need returns. But there's recent research that shows that actually people get much more satisfaction out of activities than they do out of things. And there's good evidence that the reason for that is, among other things, that activities are usually social. So when you are engaged in activities, it's usually with other people, which means that they change from one occurrence to the next. They're extended in time. They involve you with people you care about. And I think those things may not leave you disappointed in the same way that objects do.
And that's interesting because that fits with a piece of research I recently read, that it is the pursuit of the goal that is more pleasurable than the acquisition of the goal itself.
Well, that, of course, depends on what your goals are.
Well,
if you have good goals, then indeed, you know, the flow states you're talking about, which are temporary, but they're sustaining because at the end of one of these bouts of hard work, you've accomplished something that's on the way to some larger goal. So you can both be immersed in the activity while you're doing it and also see signs of progress when you're done for the day. And then, you know, as people say, it's the journey, it's not the destination. Well, that's true, but you also care about destinations.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It's not every place is Camden.
We've got to take a short break. I promise we will get to your calls. We've got a couple of lines open. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you, your experience with desires and disappointment post-acquisition or post that experience of losing yourself that both Barry Schwartz and Mark Epstein talked about. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The family training program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the family training program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The foundation offers charitable gift annuities, charitable remainder trusts, and pooled income funds. Talk to your financial advisor about how these income-generating and tax-saving tools can build resources for community organizations. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org. 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the nature of desire with Mark Epstein, a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City and the author of a number of books, including Open to Desire, The Truth of What the Buddha Taught Us. His recent book is called The Trauma of Everyday Life. Barry Schwartz is the Dorwin Cartwright Professor of Social Theory and Social Action at Swarthmore College, author of several books, including The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. All right, so let's talk about, Barry, why more is less. And, you know, I told you during the break, I wanted to talk about your pants.
So, in the beginning of my book, I describe a trip to the Gap to replace my jeans, which were disintegrating before my wife's disapproving eyes. And I told them my size, and I thought I'd be out of there in 5 seconds. And the clerk said, "Do I want slim fit, easy fit, relaxed fit, button fly, zipper fly, stone washed, acid washed?" On and on and on it went. And I said, "I want the kind that used to be the only kind," which, of course, they didn't make anymore. So I tried them all on, and I walked out with the best-fitting jeans I'd ever owned. And so I did better, thanks to all that choice, and I felt worse. And I realized, without psychotherapy, that the reason I felt worse is that when all these options are arrayed, what ends up happening is that your expectations go up and up and up. And so although I did well, the jeans fit me well, they weren't perfect. And I figured with all those possibilities, one of them should be perfect. When they only came in one style, only an idiot would expect perfection. And I think this is a common enough problem. A, it's hard to pull the trigger when there are so many options. Mm-hmm. How do you know you made the right choice? And B, you end up expecting something so good that reality inevitably ends up disappointing, and then you feel like you've made a mistake. It's your fault with all those options out there. Surely you could have done better than you actually did. And I think the same thing is true with gift giving.
Right.
Except it may be worse because, you know, if you disappoint yourself, well, you'll get over it. But if you disappoint the recipient, that's an even bigger negative result.
I wonder if you and Mark. Do you find that more and more that people are making more unreasonable demands on themselves for perfection? I mean, somehow in this culture, mediocre average has become a four-letter word. I mean,
yeah.
Can you imagine what happens to me when I tell them that their child is under the big hump in the bell curve? Oh, my God,
Well, I think what Barry was saying before about trying on the jeans is such a good example. And the way that he felt when one of them wasn't perfect, that maybe there was a problem in himself, you know, that somehow he was flawed. I think that's the thing with desire, is that people personalize the failure to achieve the kind of perfection that we're all striving for. And the point that I've been trying to make over and over again is that it's inherent to the nature of desire to leave you a little bit disappointed. And so we don't have to do that extra thing of making it a problem with us.
Let's go right to the phones here. We've got Holly on the line. Hi, Holly.
Hi, good morning. You know, it's interesting because I think for myself, at least, I found the perfect balance between desiring things and getting that fulfillment of having them, because I go on eBay a lot, and my husband and I, you know, I like to shop, but I don't like to spend. And so, you know, if I need to replace a pair of jeans, let's say, and I already know that a particular Gap, you know, jean fits me really well, or my daughter needs a sweater or something like that, I find it very satisfying to go on eBay, and I love the hunt and scrolling through possibly hundreds of items until I find the just right one, bid on it, or, you know, if it's a buy it now kind of format, stay within a particular budget that I've set for myself or a range that I've set, and have it delivered. And I find that it's a win-win. I've taken something off someone's hands. I have filled a gap or perceived gap in my wardrobe or my husband's or children's. I've saved money. And I don't know. It's tremendously satisfying, I think, much more than, you know, going to the mall.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's a kind of that's a kind of flow state that we were talking about before, and you can hear it in the enjoyment of the hunt. You know, the activity is as important as the object, but the object is important also if it can be gotten for the right price, and the sense of giving that she's not doing it only for herself, that she's doing it for her family. So there's a lot of satisfaction there. And I think that's to be praised. You know, that's a wonderful thing.
Well, I want to ask you a not directly related question about desire and craving.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you know, are able to, you know, like the caller we just heard, they have this desire, but there's also a line here where others, you know, just kind of give in to their desires or hungers, and they might experience regret after the fact. What's the difference? What happens when desire turns to craving?
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, I've spent a lot of time studying the Eastern psychologies, mm. the psychologies of Buddhism in particular. And when the Buddha gave his psychological teachings, he did it in the form of the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
The first truth is that life is tinged with a sense of pervasive unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And the second truth is that the cause of that suffering is craving, but it's sometimes translated as the cause of that suffering is desire. So a lot of people drawn to that world set desire up as the enemy and think that you know, any kind of desire is somehow going to bring about the inevitable suffering. But I think there is a distinction. Craving is needing a specific outcome, the way you were talking before about the need for perfection. And desire is more open. Desire is like you try, like the woman who just called in, you try your best to reach your goal, but you're willing to accept whatever comes your way. And I think that desire can easily turn into craving, and craving can easily take over desire, but they're different things.
It's almost, as you describe it, almost like a hug. One is a gentle, open, loving hug, caring for other, and the other is the kind of hug where it's difficult to breathe, where you just
squeeze. Well, we all know the difference between clinging and craving,
yeah.
Between clinging and hugging.
Yeah.
And clinging is the other word that's used for craving, you know? So when the hug becomes a cling, that's the difference between craving and desire.
What gets us there? What gets us back?
What gets us back to?
How can we shift a craving back to a desire? We can't just say, well, that's what I'm doing, let me do it differently, or can
I? Yeah, well, I think the answer to that question, the people who have solved that question the best in our culture are mm-hmm. The people who go to Alcoholics Anonymous.
How so?
Well, that's actually, for many people, a really effective way of dealing with the craving for the substance, for alcohol or whatever substance. That the first step at AA is to admit your helplessness, you know, and to turn your will over to the higher power as you envision it, and to take refuge in the community of other helpless people. There's something very profound there.
Well, it's you know, Barry alluded to this earlier about being with others and being with kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And you know, I got to tell you, Mark, my experience with that is, you know, kindred spirits at one level in those rooms. But at another level, you're with a group of fellow vulnerable people who are acknowledging their vulnerability, and that's the birthplace of intimacy. You don't have intimacy without owning your vulnerability.
No, I totally agree.
You know, that's Brené Brown's work. Let's go back to the phones. We've got CJ on the line. Hi, CJ. Hello?
Hi there. Sorry about that. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, so I just wanted to interject something. In the beginning of the program, you talked about sort of like this Judeo-Christian concept of, you know, don't covet. And on the surface, it seems like an unreasonable thing, but as you learn a little bit more about it, I'm Catholic myself. The point is not to not have the desires. I mean, of course, that's ridiculous, but, you know, it's not to cultivate them. And I think that's sort of a missing piece that we don't always talk about in our culture. You know, if you want something and you get up every morning and you're thinking about it, I think it's a lot easier for those desires to get out of control. Whereas if you have a desire and you recognize it for what it is, it's just, you know, of course this is something I want, but then make a discernment as to whether or not you really need it. Or maybe you want it more than maybe you should, and you can direct your attention elsewhere and keep it in perspective. I think that makes a huge difference. And also just wanted to add that, you know, when it comes to the, again, like the Catholic point of view or the Christian point of view, it's not so much the desires as what you do about them.
Huh. Yeah, and I've got to tell you, CJ, Barry Schwartz is here in the studio with me, so I'm able to see his body language. And Barry, you looked like you were having a reaction to what CJ was saying. And by the way, CJ, thanks so much for your call, and thanks for listening to the show.
Well, I think CJ made an extremely astute observation. He distinguished between our being able to distinguish things we need from things we want. That's a distinction that seems to me to have almost vanished from modern affluent society. Every want is a need, and we cultivate and raise the importance of all of these wants. It's not so easy to acknowledge that you would like X, but it's really not that important, and I'm going to go about my business. It starts to loom larger and larger, and it takes over your entire life. So I think that the kind of discipline that would enable you to distinguish what you need from what you want and show real gratitude when you happen to get something that you want might be the secret that gets us over the hump in this holiday season. I think it takes an enormous amount of practice to adopt this attitude toward material things, which is different from the one that Madison Avenue is trying to inculcate in us.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'm laying in bed, and I want to toss this to you, Mark. Sometimes I'm laying in bed at night, and I'm thinking, about 2 pounds of potato chips would be good about now, washed down with some chocolate tasty cake. And it's at times like that I'm grateful that I can't get out of bed and get it. I don't know if you're aware of this, Mark. I'm a quadriplegic, so thank God, you know, I don't have to deal with this. But you know, I want to give you a softball here, Mark. about not nurturing desire and how it turns to craving.
Yeah.
And here's the softball. I mean, in order to do that, we have to be kind of awake and aware and mindful.
Well, it's possible. It actually is possible to train yourself to observe your thoughts and feelings. It's possible to use the mind to observe the mind and thereby to shape the mind. And, you know, the spiritual traditions of the world have known this for hundreds and thousands of years. And there are methodologies in all of the spiritual traditions, and now in our own psychotherapy tradition, there are methodologies for doing just that. And the techniques are very simple, but the discipline that's required is difficult, because the mind balks at our attempts to shape it. You know, the instinctive cravings run very deep. So that becomes a lifelong endeavor, and one that can bear a lot of fruit.
And, you know, training the mind is almost like training yourself to play a musical instrument.
Yeah, it's almost like raising a child.
Yeah.
And we know how long that takes and how hard that is.
Yeah. And nobody's done it perfectly yet.
Only a few people in the history of mankind, we think, have done it perfectly, but they've had a huge influence.
We've got to take a short break again. We're talking about desire, what it is, when it turns to craving, how to manage it, and we're just talking about how to manage our own minds. My guests are Barry Schwartz. He's a professor of social theory and social action. I'm going to talk more about that at Swarthmore College. The author of several books, including The Paradox of Choice. Mark Epstein is a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City. He's the author of a number of books, including Open to Desire, The Truth of What the Buddha Taught, and The Trauma of Everyday Life. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Caring Friends Home Care, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides in-home non-medical services such as home health aids, assistance with medications, meal preparation, dressing, hygiene, light housekeeping, and more. With hourly or live-in care, clients can remain in their own homes or receive additional support in long-term care communities. Details available at caringfriendshomecare.org.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Wistar proudly supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new 7-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, designed to accelerate scientific discoveries. Here, Wistar scientists are working together to create cancer treatment vaccines. These unique vaccines direct the body's own blood cells to attack cancer cells. Learn more about this and other advances at Wistar.org. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about desire, what it is, what it's all about, and why it's so powerful around the holidays. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to talk about not just too many choices, Barry and Mark, but what happens when we have too few choices. That can lead to despair, and I'm thinking of, in some respects, myself, my health. There are people with cancer, and they don't have enough choice there. So what are we talking about here? And go on, Barry.
So there's 50 years of research in psychology about the importance of choice to well-being, the importance of being, as some people sometimes describe it, the author of your own life, the importance of autonomy and the importance of control. So there's no ambiguity among psychologists that choice is essential for well-being. And how much is the right amount is a more complicated question. And the mistake that we all made as psychologists until fairly recently was to assume that since choice is good, more choice must be better. And what we now know is that that's not true. A point can be reached where it becomes debilitating rather than liberating. And people who willfully misunderstand what I write will say things like, what do you want? Do you want to go back to the Soviet Union where, you know, or Ford, where you can get any color car you want as long as it's black? And no one has ever suggested that the optimal amount of choice for people is none. So I think you're absolutely right. And in some respects, what my book is about is the problem that people of privilege have. And people who are struggling to make a living, their problem is not that they have too much choice. Their problem is that they have much too little, constrained by their financial circumstances. Most of the world's problem is that it has too little choice, not too much choice.
You talk about people of privilege or in first world countries. You said we're obsessed with happiness.
Well, it does seem to be astonishing how much people care about happiness in our culture. And a whole field has grown up in psychology in the last 20 years, the psychology of happiness. It's odd that there was no such field before. But the extraordinary thing is that when you talk to people who grew up, say, in Asian cultures, it's amazing how unimportant happiness is. It's about meeting your responsibilities to other people, to your family, to your community, and so on. And happiness is just, you know, it's an irrelevance, it's a frivolity, it's a byproduct. It's the aim of life is not to be happy. The aim of life is to do what you're supposed to do. And in the Western world, the modern Western world, the aim of life is to be happy.
I wonder if the definition of happiness changes, or maybe, Mark, my experience is that what we're after is really a sense of well-being. But I know many Buddhist teachers feel that, you know, I think it was the Dalai Lama. I recently heard him speak in Boston, and he said, we all suffer, and we all want happiness.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say to Barry. You know, the Dalai Lama is probably the most respected Asian Buddhist teacher in our world, and he starts every single talk with, all people want happiness, all people want to be happy, you know, Asian or Western alike. But I think what he's getting at, you know, he's using the sort of small definition of happiness to mm-hmm. pull people in, and then he starts to talk about, well, what's really going to make you happy? And that's where he starts to sound like Barry. You know, are all these choices going to make you happy? He talks about going to a mall in Zurich and walking by the windows and seeing, you know, so many things, so many watches. He loves watches. So many things. There were things he didn't even know he wanted, he says. He didn't even know they existed, but when he saw them, he wanted them. So he's actually teaching about a higher kind of happiness that comes when you have disciplined your own mind, so that you're not instinctively craving the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. Because to live a human life, you're not going to get only things that are pleasant. You know, inevitably, you're going to get the unpleasant. And if your mind is going to react aversively to that, you're going to suffer. So he's saying there's a higher kind of happiness that's willing to embrace the totality of our human experience in which, you know, inevitably there's going to be illness and death and loss and so on.
You talked about pushing away unhappiness. So, you know, as a layman, I'll say, of course we do.
Yep.
Who wants to be happy? Unhappy.
Who wants to be unhappy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see my grandmother calling you a bad name in Yiddish.
But, you know, a couple of psychologists published a paper about a year ago that looked at what the definition of happiness has been across historical time and across cultures. And until very recently, almost universally, the first definition of happiness you would find in dictionaries around the world was good fortune. So what it meant to be happy was to be lucky. You will still see in some dictionaries, even now, the first definition of happiness is good fortune, and then there may be other ones about positive emotion and satisfaction with your life. So saying we all want to be happy, unfortunately, doesn't tell us enough, because what that word means is so different to different people and at different times.
I love the phrase good fortune. I love the phrase lucky, because that's how I experience my life, as incredible luck. And if we can really, you know, look over the trajectory of our lives, we are all so, so lucky. And that word implies humility, not a big I with this big personal pronoun, I did, I accomplished. You know, it's humility and grace. Mark?
Yeah, well, I have a good story about that from when I was young and traveling in Asia, and I went to a renowned Buddhist teacher in Thailand and asked him about this. And the way he answered the question was to hold his drinking glass. He held it up to me and he said, do you see this glass? I love this glass. It holds the water admirably. When the sun shines on it, it reflects the light beautifully. But for me, he said, the glass is already broken. When the wind blows and knocks it off the shelf, or when my elbow hits it and it falls and breaks, I say, of course. But because, and this was where the real teaching was, because for me the glass is already broken, every minute with it is precious. Mm-hmm. And it's that ability to live your life, you know, broken as it may be, still in touch with the preciousness that I think is the real good fortune.
Do we need... I wonder, and this is, a lot of people ask me this, do we need, as Sartre said, the presence of death on our shoulder, knowing that not just we are broken, but the end is present somewhere? Knowing that our life is so fragile, do we need that in order to experience its preciousness?
Well, I think we all know that. I don't think there's anyone who's not aware of that. So what do we do with that knowledge, you know? And I think there are various approaches, one being to suppress or repress it, and the other to keep it in some way close to our consciousness in a way that allows us to experience the preciousness of things. Mm.
But of course, it could have a paradoxical effect if it's too front and center in your mind, the impermanence of life. Then every decision you make and every activity you engage in becomes so much more important, because you don't know how many moments you've got left and how many decisions you've got left. And I could easily see people completely paralyzed into inaction, because the thought of death makes every choice so momentous that they want to get it exactly right.
Barry might suggest that it's how we embrace that phenomenon of death. Barry?
Yeah, I think it's the fear of it that paralyzes people and leads to a kind of obsessive inability to make a choice. But the willingness to let it be real, I think helps us with those choices.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Barry, you said that our relentless pursuit of happiness might suggest that we're unhappy. Are we?
Well, the research suggests, strikingly, using questionnaires, 7-point scales, 10-point scales, and stuff like that, that roughly 70% of people the world over are happy. Now, I guess that's good news. but, of course, people who are 7 on a 10-point scale want to be 9, and people who are 5 on a 10-point scale want to be 7. But even in really, impoverished societies, the average person is happy, whatever it means when they answer in that way on questionnaires. So I guess that means the best data we have is that most people are happy.
Most people are happy and want to be happier, don't know it, don't know they're happy, think they're unhappy or need more.
Well, they say they're happy, but they want to be happier. I don't think this implies that they organize their lives around moving from a 5 to a 7 or a 7 to a 9. It's just that they recognize that as happy as they may be, they could be even happier, life could be even better, and they won't turn it away should good fortune smile upon them.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
Are you happy?
Am I happy?
Yeah.
Some of the time.
Ah. And the rest?
The rest of the time, no.
All right. So are we back to that 2 o'clock appointment in my office?
I'll come to you. How's that?
You have been writing about trauma throughout your career. Give us the thumbnail of what this new book is about.
The thumbnail is if we're not suffering from post-traumatic stress, we're suffering from pre-traumatic stress because of what we were talking about before. We all know that old age, illness and death, loss and separation, et cetera, is hovering just out of reach if it hasn't hit us already. So trauma is a... it's part of our birthright, you know. It's part of our experience. It flows underneath even our happy lives, and most the instinctive thing to do is to deny that or push it away. But there's something kind of interesting about letting it in, and that's what I'm trying to say in the book. Similar to what I was saying about desire.
About desire to let it in, as though we have a choice. I mean, it's
well,
there.
We don't have we have choices with all of this, but it's all percolating underneath anyway.
Well, listen, gentlemen, I have to say, I don't know if it's desire or craving. I think it's craving. I'm craving more time, but our is over, and I'm so sorry about that. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Take care to both of you. We spoke with Barry Schwartz here at Swarthmore, Dr. Mark Epstein, who wrote The Trauma of Everyday Life. We're going to take this conversation to a new level next week. We're going to look at what happens when craving turns into addiction. We're going to hear about new treatments and ways of looking at addiction next week on Voices. Well, you can follow us at Twitter with Voices in the Fam. You can email us at voices@whyy.org. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Here in